Welcome back to Unfit to Print. This is CKUT on 90.3 FM, broadcasting live from Montreal. My name is Amy Lloyd.
And I'm Maya Abitson.
Today we broadcast from the Geojiage, the traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee and the Anishinaabe Nations. The time now is 5:01.
This week we have for you an interview with Dr. Evangelos Zialas, who received his PhD in Film and Moving Image Studies from Concordia University. Dr. Zialas has published numerous bodies of research, specifically regarding pornographic film and queer culture. He is also an editorial board member of Porn Studies, a quarterly peer-reviewed academic journal examining pornographic works. We talked to Dr. Zialas about his areas of research, the socio-political impact of intersectional queer figures in porn, the influence of technology in gay porn, and why it is important to study porn along with sex in a disciplinary setting. We want to issue a content warning, as this interview discusses involuntary outing, offensive stereotypes portrayed in porn, and homophobia. Considering the length of the interview, we have split up our conversation with Dr. Zialas into two parts. Today you'll hear part one. Before we get to the interview, we have the usual headline roundup and a few of our favorite tunes. Don't go anywhere, we'll be right back in a few minutes.
That was Only You by Anemone. The time is 5:09. Now for our weekly headline roundup. This past Monday, Elizabeth May announced that she will be stepping down from her position as Green Party leader regarding the next election. Taking place in the House of Commons, her resignation was a surprise. Her reason for the resignation was because of a promise she made to her daughter. May stated that, quote, "My daughter looked at this also for my health. You can work like harder than anybody's ever seen, but it's not good for you," unquote. During her resignation announcement, May also addressed, quote, "Indigenous issues in the House of Commons," unquote, according to APTN News. She said, quote, "We have to respond immediately and cancel the appeal of Human Rights Tribunal decision that there is specifically money owed for what Human Rights Tribunal found to be reckless and willful," quote, unquote, "reckless and willful violation of the human rights of Indigenous children in this country," unquote.
Only during the 1998 ice storm did more people lose power across the province than people did during this weekend's windstorm, which caused a loss of power in 990,000 homes and businesses across Montreal at its height. As of Monday, 50 schools have been closed due to outages. On the bright side, 94% of Hydro-Québec's clientele have been restored power, save for some in the rural eastern townships. Hydro-Québec repair crews were deployed this weekend, with reinforcement from Detroit, Ottawa, and New Brunswick. The Hydro-Québec CEO promised all power would be reconnected by Tuesday, as their first and foremost concern was restoring electricity serving hospitals and water treatment plants. It has been observed that due to climate change, ice storms as such have become more of a threat to Montreal in the coming winters. It has been suggested to bury electrical cables as to stop brownouts as such from occurring annually. The CEO, however, has rejected the idea, saying that, quote, "it sounds like an easy solution, but it would cost $100 billion to bury all the cables," unquote. Whereas burying cables may not be an option, the CEO assured the public that Hydro-Québec is looking for alternative means to stormproof their electricity systems, such as different poles or new cable coverings.
An anonymous activist group known as the, quote, "anti-colonial zombies," unquote, recently revealed that they were the group behind the splattering of orange paint on the statue of Sir John A. Macdonald in downtown Montreal. The statue has been painted before. Previous colors include red, blue, and green. According to APTN News, the splattering of this paint is to, quote, "demonstrate its contested status for those who believe it celebrates genocide," unquote. No Borders Media released a statement on Facebook saying, quote, "We are the dead that you have forgotten. Our skeletons buried between 1799 and 1855 remain here in the thousands. You have covered us in asphalt, concrete, and colonial-themed parks. You have desecrated our memories with monuments to the architects of genocide, like the racist John A. Macdonald, who attacked the culture and traditions of the indigenous people of Turtle Island," unquote. The statement continues to say that, quote, "We have risen to attack the monument in orange paint. Orange represents both our sacred day, what you call Halloween, but it's also an appropriate way to desecrate the orange man, John A. Macdonald, who was a member of the racist and anti-Catholic Orange Order," unquote. No Borders Media concluded with the statement, quote, "Happy anti-colonial Halloween," unquote.
Dana, a Muslim woman living in Laval, received an anonymous Islamophobic letter in her mailbox this past Friday, specifically criticizing the religious symbols she and her family wears. The letter's question is why Dana would let her daughters wear a veil, as well as wishes shame on her and men imams, and told her that Quebec, quote, "doesn't want Islamic hijabs," unquote. Dana, who did not want her real name published, was born in Egypt but spends most of her life in Canada. She brought her case to the Laval police, who filed a report and said that though the letter is a, quote, "hate incident," unquote, it does not suggest any specific harm to Dana and her family. Furthermore, the letter is anonymous, so there's little to trace its origins to. As acts of racism rise in Quebec amidst the passing of Bill 21 this past spring, the Muslim community is getting attacked more often but, quote, "won't go to the police because they don't think they'll be taken seriously," unquote, says volunteer spokesperson Hanadi Saad.
That was our weekly headline roundup. Please stay tuned for our interview, but first we have some songs for you. Please enjoy 7 Minutes by Tops, followed by King Princess with Ain't Together.
and I'd love to see someone else call you. And all this in between, you think it's hard for me to tell you're falling. We're falling. Being chill with you. Oh, the kills, I ain't chill at all. Let up. We say I love you, but we ain't together. Do you think labels make it taste much better? Baby, you don't gotta worry about nothing. Cause everybody knows that you and I got that something. Being chill with you. Oh, it kills, I ain't chill.
Welcome back to Unfit to Print. The time now is 5:19. Once again, that was 7 minutes by Tops, followed by King Princess with Ain't Together. You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
Up next is our interview with Dr. Evangelos Zialas, where we discuss his areas of research, the sociopolitical impact of intersectional queer figures in porn, and how the medium itself is a powerful tool. Once again, we want to issue a content warning, as this interview discusses involuntary outing, offensive stereotypes portrayed in porn, and homophobia. Enjoy!
Hi, Amy.
Hi. So firstly, what is the main focus of your research?
Of my research is primarily gay male sexual representation and culture. That's my primary focus, but overall I would say that my research also looks at the ways in which gay male sexual representation and culture overlaps with issues relating to surveillance, and which includes, you know, the impacts of data collection, big data, and the use of algorithms, as well as queer cultural critique, so the way in which queer cultural criticism operates within gay male sexual culture.
So with a PhD in film studies, you must have studied a lot of different genres of cinematography. Why do pornographic films interest you for research specifically?
So I think for me it had to do with the fact that my with my adolescence and discovering porn as a space where I could explore my own sexuality and sexual identity. You know, so this was the late 90s, the era of dial-up internet, which means that I had to wait, you know, entire minutes just for a single picture. Very different than the world we live in now. But I guess my personal interest in porn is really tied to my coming of age, right? And as I made my way through university, and especially through a graduate school, the proliferation of pornography and the evolving conversations and discussions around porn made me realize that my personal experience was, in fact, more universal than I had previously believed it to be. So, you know, I think that a lot of gay men my age really turn to the internet, and in particular internet porn, to find refuge and knowledge about themselves and their sexuality at a time when gay acceptance was increasing, particularly in the Western world, but definitely isn't anywhere where it is today. So my academic interest, I would say, really peaked when I started paying close attention to the various themes within gay male pornography. And I started to notice certain trends, particularly around the creation and the focus on homosocial spaces, so spaces that are same-sex segregated, if you will. And I noticed that they weren't only popular, but they were also kind of tinged with this kind of political undercurrent. You know, something about displaying graphic sex in spaces that are often heavily policed and often heavily policed same-sex desire and activity. And here are some specific examples. I'm thinking of places like the military, the fraternity, the prison, and so on and so forth. So my own story into the world of porn criticism came out of a desire to better understand and position porn as something political, but something that's also sort of inextricable, something that can't be, you know, disconnected from or untangled from gay male identity and culture.
So an online source cites your three main focuses are surveillance, pornography, and queer culture. How do these topics intersect?
So, I would say that broadly speaking, surveillance is sort of the disciplinary intervention into the lives of citizens, and usually by institutional but increasingly corporate powers. You know, if you're thinking of the, like, Michel Foucault and his foundation, or his formulation of the disciplinary society, which he outlined in his very famous study, Discipline and Punish, back in the mid-70s. So I think that queer people still exist in this kind of top-down power system in terms of, you know, controlling, scrutinizing, and punishing different aspects of queer existence, be it sex, be it bodies, be it representation or culture. And so this act of social control is exercised, I would say, through the regulation of sex and sexuality, which, again, Michel Foucault discussed as a form of surveillance in and of itself. In his other really famous study, The History of Sexuality, especially the first volume, where he discusses the rise of biopower or the use of control and power through the monitoring and the regulation of biology in this, you know, more than just biology, the idea of controlling sex and sexuality and the uses of the body for the purposes of the state or for profit. So, I mean, oddly enough, when looking back at some of the most popular spaces, you know, in gay porn, especially where they were traditionally set in, they were spaces of institutional power, right? So like the military, the church, the prison, the police force, and so on and so forth. And so early on, my interest in surveillance and gay porn was really solidified by the complex engagement gay porn made with disciplinary spaces. Now, over the last 15 or 20 years or so, the ubiquity of both recording and data technology has evolved, both the meaning and practices of surveillance, right? So that doesn't mean that the theoretical disciplinary elements of surveillance have disappeared. really can't be understated, right? Social media is, in my opinion, and in the professional opinion of many scholars, a form of surveillance technology. Things like online shopping is surveillance technology. You know, using your passport is surveillance technology. GPS location technology is surveillance technology. And so when we look at queer, but here I'll say specifically gay male culture, the popularity of things like dating and hookup apps such as Grindr and Scruff have completely altered not only what it means to be gay and engage with other gay men as sexual partners or as members of the community, but it also speaks to the way in which surveillance and surveillance technologies have been integrated into the daily lives of gay men and queer people overall. So, in fact, I actually published a paper a few years ago, I think it was published in 2015, where I argued that dating and hookup apps themselves double as kind of amateur porn platforms and places where gay men can exchange pictures, videos, explicit pictures and videos with each other, or engage in erotic chat or sexting, if you will, which, you know, in the weirdest ways, really kind of harkens back to earlier forms of internet porn usage. So here I'm thinking of like chatting anonymously in chat rooms, or maybe sharing images through mail services or messaging services. It's interesting to see the way in which that exchange amongst gay men can sort of bring people back to this sort of earlier form of interactivity, but obviously becoming far more heightened with the use of surveillance technologies and GPS technologies, right? So, I mean, the ubiquity of GPS location devices and recording technology has opened up a whole new realm of interactive and DIY porn, things like webcamming, amateur videos being posted on places like XTube, the creation of fans-only accounts, which is indie amateur porn one can access for a small subscription fee that often uses places like Twitter as a platform for sharing and distributing self-made porn, which I would call sort of like micro-porn that operates in a micro-transaction economy. And then, of course, there's the monolith that is Pornhub, you know, the giant web that collects a copious amount of data on users and, among other things, produces data analytics or insights on porn user consumption. So in the 21st century, I don't really think that you can really talk about queerness or in this particular, queerness in general, but I would say queer or gay sex and sexuality without among other things, the consideration of and surveillance.
So we talked about, you know, what your initial interest in this realm was, but I want to know what the initial catalyst was behind choosing to study this and choosing to discuss porn in a serious academic setting.
So I think that I touched upon that a little bit previously, but I think that my initial interest in disciplinary spaces and current focus on the impact of big data and data analytics on gay sexuality and representation is, for me, again, tied to not only my coming of age, if you will, in the late 90s, but I think it can really be sort of pinpointed to a very specific moment of trauma, I would say, that occurred during my adolescence. So, when I was in grade 11, a classmate who I also considered a friend hacked into my computer, and he found my secret stash of gay porn that I had collected and kept on my computer. As I mentioned before, you know, internet porn was very different back then. You would have to wait an entire minute for a single picture, and a lot of times when you got access to that picture, the first thing that you would do is save it so that you could go back to your own porn repository when you wanted to, and you wouldn't have to wait for hours to get access to the material that you discovered. And when he found my secret stash of gay porn in, I guess, a hidden file that I kept somewhere, although clearly I didn't hide it well enough, he then went to school and actually told not everybody, but I would say a select few number of individuals who came to question me essentially about the veracity of my classmates' claims. And this was a really terrifying moment for me. You know, I was semi-outed by someone I considered a friend who not only violated my privacy, but several federal laws in the process, you know, investigating what I can only assume was, you know, a hunch, you know, if you will. Mm-hmm. And to this day, I can't help but wonder why he felt the need to go searching, you know, through my computer. But more than that, I still think about how he knew where to look. You know, there's something to this day that still unsettles me about that whole ordeal. So what I remember most, though, about that entire scenario and situation was, in fact, the moment of being caught, if you will, critical theorists would call the moment of interpolation when you're caught breaking the law, if you will. So, I mean, picture this. It's 1999, you're home alone, you're chatting with a friend over ICQ, which back then was a popular instant messaging platform. Your friend asks you to accept a file transfer of a picture he's recently drawn. You accept, you open it, but it doesn't work. Your friend apologizes and resends the file, and this time it works when you click on it. And it turns out that it's a drawing of, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, an anime-style dragon. If I remember clearly, again, this was quite some time ago, that particular person was really into anime. So, you know, you're talking about it, you're complimenting them on their talent, and of course at some point you get up to go to the bathroom. And I remember very clearly coming back from the bathroom and coming back to my desk and seeing all of these images of gay porn splashed across my computer screen and my CD-ROM drive opening and closing, you know, as though it were possessed by, like, a demon. So I just remember making, like, a beeline to my computer and turning it off and rebooting it. And luckily, everything goes back to normal. Of course, that is until the next day when I head to school. So, you know, this, again, was 1999, and there were far fewer resources to support someone going through a kind of forced outing. Mm-hmm. And I would say that overall, there was also, you know, just less acceptance of queerness and queer people. So I just remember feeling really stuck and really paralyzed. You know, I couldn't really press charges against this individual. That would mean I would have to fully, you know, come out. Mm-hmm. And I just wasn't ready to do that back then. I wasn't ready to accept the consequences that may have come from my friends, from my family, and everything else. And that event had a really detrimental effect on me. I mean, if you go back, you can see that my grades plummeted. I also remember people that I used to talk to and used to invite me to go out stopped inviting me to go out. And I just remember walking the hallway feeling very vulnerable and insecure, right? Because I didn't know who had heard about, quote-unquote, the rumor and who hadn't. You know, so I mean, for better or worse, it was a formative moment in my life. And one that may very well continue to manifest itself in my ongoing research interest. So I would say that this moment is really the sort of underlying catalyst that I think compelled me to really look at gay pornography, and then later on, to an extent, like the focus on surveillance and sexual identity. And maybe to this day, it's still the reason why I continue to focus on these three intersections.
So how do you think gay pornography itself contributes to Western culture today?
So I think that porn in general is kind of the canary in the mind of both liberalism and democracy, right? So several studies have shown that the more accepting of porn a society or culture is, the more freedom, in particular, women and sexual minorities have. And an excellent study that I would recommend to all of your listeners would be Brian McNair's Porno Chic, How Pornography Changed the World and Made It a Better Place, which was published back in 2015. You know, and pornography has historically been aligned with discourses of freedom, namely the freedom to critique or mock people and institutions of power. And another really good study about the origins of porn and freedom is Lynn Hunt's anthology, The Invention of Pornography, Obscenity, and the Origins of Modernity, 1500 to 1800. So I think that when we look hit something like amateur porn, DIY porn, or micro porn. And the term that technology sort of like really facilitated towards smaller independent productions, the ability for non-professionals to share their sexuality or incorporate their sexuality outside of a mainstream corporate structure and outside corporate and mainstream normative framework, I think is really, really, really important in terms of the way porn continues to contribute to discourses of freedom, liberalism, and democracy. Right, so the proliferation of micro and indie porn means that more people get to be included in sexual culture, but in particular in queer sexual culture, and it opens up new spaces for people who have not been traditionally been included to make money and also alter what we consider the standards of desire. And I think this challenge to institutional and normative power is also why we're seeing a growing backlash to porn, right? So here I'm thinking of the United Kingdom's digital economy bill or the Republican Party shutting down Craigslist personal ads. Both initiatives, of course, were done, you know, in order to, quote-unquote, protect children and the young. We also saw, you know, porn has become a major battleground in the earlier parts of the decade, especially revolving around questions of safer sex. And here I'm thinking about the not-for-profit organization, the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, based in California, and their introduction of Measure B, which is a bill that wanted to ban the production of condomless sex in porn in the state of California. And of course, it was widely seen as a repressive measure that intervened into the private sexual activities and decisions, you know, of adults, and eventually it was defeated. But the very fact that we saw a bill like this be tabled at the state legislature, I think is quite quite concerning. So I think that overall the role that porn continues to play in Western society is one of ensuring that individual liberties and freedom remain in the hands, again, of individuals.
So how have you seen pornographic ideals and topics change since you've begun researching this medium?
Suggests unsafe sex, and here I'm using the term condomless sex and raw sex, if you will, because of advancements in pharmaceutical technologies such as PrEP and Truvada that have made it, I don't want to say impossible, but almost impossible to actually transmit the HIV virus. So barebacking as a term itself was very much rooted in a kind of stigma, but also a very specific fantasy of risk related to the transmission of HIV, of the HIV virus. I think this turn towards raw sex and condomless sex is not only an attempt to destigmatize the function and the way in which gay men see the lack of use of condoms, but it also acknowledges the way in which the risk of that was associated with terms like barebacking and condomless sex back in the 90s and in the 2000s has really changed as a result of pharmaceutical advancements which have developed what's called a chemical prophylaxis, right? So this idea of not necessarily having a physical prophylaxis condom, but instead having a chemical one that protects you internally by the taking of medication.
What are some prominent features of queer culture that are present in today's porn industry?
I would sort of repeat what I sort of just said, but again, I would say that increased visibility of trans actors, as well as the popularity of older men or quote-unquote daddy figures, so men in their 40s and 50s, these silver daddies, as well as the mainstreaming of sex without condoms, I would say, are the most prominent features of queer culture that we're seeing being reflected on the screen.
So I also wanted to explore one paper in specific, that being the new porn wars representing gay male sexuality in the Middle East. You discussed representations of Middle Eastern men in gay porn. So would you mind discussing your stance on the, as you say, performative potentials in Arab-themed films?
Yeah. So I just want to sort of start off by mentioning that you know, I think that a lot of those films came out of a very particular socio-political context, so namely post-9/11 Western culture. And I would say that instead of performative Arabism, what we've actually started to see in the wake of those representations are more and more Arab performers in gay male porn, as well as more and more Arab men being included in conversations around gay and queer culture. And of course, we've also seen this happen in heterosexual porn as well. And here I'm thinking of the controversial figure Mia Khalifa, who has generated controversy for wearing and sexualizing the hijab in porn, especially when she herself is not Muslim. She is actually a Lebanese Christian woman. That being said, I would say that overall, I think that these early performative texts did play around with constructions of identity, and I think that they opened up a space for including figures that at that time were really being vilified in mainstream media and in cultural political conversations, and even in queer cultural political conversations, for being too religious or too sexually repressive, and of course as these, you know, figurative threats to quote-unquote national security. Now, of course, that's not to say that the representations that came out were uniformly interested in such political matters, but I would say that some of the representations that I discussed in that particular paper were very much interested in the politics of including Arab men in contemporary gay male sexual culture. And here I'm thinking of the films that Raging Stallion Studios put out, as well as the video Colin O'Neill has put out. And I remember when I was researching this topic for my master's thesis. So in fact, this paper was published in 2015, but the research for this paper was done in the late 2000s. And it was derived primarily from my master's thesis. And I remember when I was making my way through these revisions, I had reached out to I had reached out to the owner, Chris Ward, of Radiant Valley Studios to discuss, you know, Arabesque and why he decided to make a film like Arabesque. And I remember him mentioning that he has like a PhD in history and that he himself is very, very, very familiar with the history of sexual contact between, you know, spaces in the Middle East and North Africa and, you know, North America and Western Europe. So I think for him that focus on the politics and the positive potentials of performativity was really at the forefront in his representation. I would also say that the Speak to Birth series, Branch, likewise has tried to challenge the border between French and Arab through this kind of ironic, transgressive, performative play between Arab and non-Arab performers. Sitapur is very irreverent. They're not interested in being politically correct. And as a studio, they really enjoy, you know, being daring and provocative and combining performers from various ethnic and racial backgrounds, which presents a sustained challenge to the implied weakness of a French identity. You know, so I mean, all porn is performative in nature, and of course, porn is very rarely politically correct, so to speak. So I think that's why porn is also just such an important space for thinking about cultural politics and identity, right? It's because it allows for alternative ways of seeing, thinking, and feeling that I think can also manifest change, you know, on the ground level, locally as well as globally. But I appreciate that that might sound a little too optimistic for some people.
So, you mentioned, you know, positive representation, somewhat controversial representation. So, I'm wondering, does this gay porn associated with the Middle East contribute to a socio-political narrative? And would you say it's positive, negative, or just somewhere in between?
So the thing that I really like about pornography is that I think that porn says a lot more about the person looking at porn rather than what is on screen, right? What are those ink blots? Oh, the Rorschach test, right? So I think of porn is a bit of a Rorschach test, right? So when it comes to something being positive or negative, I think in the end it really comes down to one's individual viewpoint. And of course, conversations about porn as being positive or negative have been around since the 70s, right? The porn wars lasted from the 70s throughout the 80s, where porn was, from some feminist circles in particular, seen as this entirely negative, repressive, patriarchal force that discriminated against women. Now, of course, there were a number of feminists who disagreed, and I would say in the grand scheme of things, we're able to sort of really emphasize the liberating potentials within porn, problematic or not. And again, as I mentioned previously with Brian McNair, he's demonstrated that regardless of whether we like an individual porn film or studio, whether we find certain representations to our liking or disliking, the very fact that it continues to exist as such and isn't over-regulated, if you will. Like, of course, Canada has obscenity laws that allow, that disallow certain forms of, like, extreme representation. But generally speaking, that the more accepting we are, regardless of what's actually being represented, it allows for everyone to have an opportunity to speak, to say, and a lot of times to pick up the camera themselves and do something about it if they don't like it, you know what I mean, without fear of repercussions. So, I mean, I think that porn can create greater levels of inclusion, right? Porn is a capitalist enterprise. You know, they're not getting money, they're not getting funding from the government to produce what they produce, right? So its function is to make money, and the way that it makes money is by tapping into the desires of its consumers, either profiting off of popular tropes or, more importantly, discovering new unrealized ones. Right? Mm-hmm. You know, so as I mentioned previously, it can generate visibility, and it can be a starting off point for different representations and conversations to happen outside of a context of porn. So it can open up conversations about sex and inclusion, about desire, and also about who gets to be visible and who is invisible when it comes to the queer community. And I think that a lot of these earlier representations have allowed for more and more of the conversations to take place and create that that kind of inclusion as well.
Welcome back to Unfit to Print. Thanks again to Dr. Zialis for discussing his past and current research with us this week. We hope you found his findings and thoughts insightful. We're going to play a song and then we'll be right back.
That was Say Can You Hear by Men I Trust. You're listening to Unfit to Print on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Thanks for tuning in this week. Much appreciated. Come back next week at the same time for another show. Once again, we want to thank Dr. Zialis for speaking with us. Don't forget, we will be playing part two of the interview next week, so stay tuned for more. We will see you all next week. Playing us out, we have This Way by Homeshake. Thank you.
wish when yeg nichi wanan na te sinat minat be kwam obestu yat che pushe kutapam che te wish when yeg malio tenam de utmana wa emotashi when the quiet enough to wipe the time get back to the tenam Shwab mit nan nichin wanan Chen zhish ka tash kipa di shan Chachie tum ne jayat Napa kwa di nan chine kenyat Ajik yam nek ino Ajik yam nek ino Ajik yam nek ino Ajik yam nek wa di no Ajik yam nek ino I can't make it no I can't make it no I can't make it no
When do me sashi min wat you want me na no Ashi min wat kamera te na no Libre tenga